You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll catch up with the latest from Israel, Lebanon and Gaza, where there appears to be no let-up in hostilities. Poland and Ukraine say they are close to agreeing a deal over grain imports as farmers around Europe continue to protest. Protests also in Hungary. We'll hear how a corruption case is continuing to make waves for Viktor Orban. And
I'm Rob Cameron, and I'll be talking about what Robert Fico's attempts to take over control of Slovakia's public broadcaster means for the media landscape in Slovakia and indeed for liberal democracy in Europe.
And we'll have a look through the papers, a roundup of design and architecture news, and finally, the stereotypes are true. A new report shows Italians really do talk with their hands. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The pilots of the cargo freighter that knocked down a highway bridge into Baltimore Harbour in the early hours of Tuesday morning had radioed for tugboat help and reported a power loss minutes earlier, federal safety officials said, citing audio from the ship's black box data recorder. As many as 95 people are still missing after last week's attack near Moscow, when gunmen sprayed concertgoers with automatic weapons and set the venue on fire. That's according to a Russian news outlet. And bus drivers in the South Korean capital of Seoul went on strike today after a last-ditch effort at negotiating a wage hike broke down, snarling the commute for the city of more than 9 million people and another million from the outskirts. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, we begin the programme on the Israel-Lebanon border, where the IDF and Hezbollah have been trading almost daily strikes since the 7th of October Hamas attack on Israel. As we know, Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia Muslim militant group, is an ally of Hamas and has close ties to Iran. Over 300 people have been killed in Lebanon since the conflict began, at least 54 of them civilians, and up to 20 have died on the Israeli side, around half of them civilians. 60,000 Israelis living in communities close to the border have fled the fighting. That's the largest such displacement in Israeli history. And around 100,000 Lebanese residents have also been evacuated from the other side of the border. Well, I'm joined now by Leila Malana Allen, who's Monocle's Middle East correspondent. Leila, good to speak to you again. What is the latest from the border region?
Morning. Yes, so all day yesterday we saw strikes going back and forth across the Lebanese-Israeli border after this attack, which happened the night before last in the village of Habariya in southern Lebanon. Now, what happened is that Israel hit a centre, which this group in southern Lebanon, Jamaat Islamiyah, says is a centre for rescue workers, a medical centre. Now, it's important to point out that in southern Lebanon, the Islamic groups there, which include Hezbollah, run a lot of the social services. They are not just military groups. So this centre that they hit was full of what are their local ambulance workers, which is how the system works in southern Lebanon. Now, Israel maintains that there was at least one known terrorist there, somebody from that group who they say was a Hamas supporter. And they maintain that the other people they killed were terrorists as well. Lots of evidence from local Lebanese media says that absolutely wasn't the case and that ambulances were hit and these were Lebanese rescue workers. Yesterday we had strikes going back and forth. As you say, more than 300 people, about 320 already have been killed in southern Lebanon, but nearly 100 of those have been killed in just the last 2 weeks. So things really are escalating.
And Hezbollah promises to avenge the attack. It says it will not pass without punishment. Do you think the situation is likely to escalate?
So Hezbollah says this about almost every attack. So we have been seeing strikes ongoing back and forth since the 8th of October, since things did start to escalate on that border. Whether it escalates further into more than these consistent strikes going back and forth. I mean, you know, 320 people dead on the Lebanese side is no small number. And the problem is that, of course, even though there have been about 100,000 people evacuated from the Lebanese side of the border, they're not set up like the Israeli side of the border, where there are lots and lots of shelters, etc., which is why the death count is much, much lower on the Israeli side. In terms of moving further into something that looks like an actual conflict, forces on both sides of the border have been ready for this for a long time, but it's clear that that's not really what either wants at the moment. It's certainly not in Hezbollah's interest to turn this into a full-scale war. There's still a lot of fear about what happened in 2006, the last time there was a full-scale war where more than 1,000 Lebanese died, and Hezbollah is in a leadership position in Lebanon. They don't want lots of Lebanese dying. And on Israel's side, you know, at the moment, they've been trying to just retaliate and not push things any further.
And of course, the fear is that Iran might get directly involved. But in fact, at the moment, it seems that there's no appetite coming from there.
There seems little appetite and potentially not that much ability either. Now, firstly, of course, Iran is heavily involved in this conflict. They fund Hamas, they fund Hezbollah, they also fund the Houthis, who have been launching strikes into the Red Sea on cargo ships. This group in Yemen, who they say is in retaliation for what's happening in Gaza. So they are heavily involved through their proxies. Now, immediately after the 7th of October attacks, there was a lot of fear that Iran would immediately kind of step up, and this was their opportunity to launch all-out war against Israel. They immediately backed off. They made it quite clear that actually they weren't going to step up and help Hamas in any kind of all-out war against Israel. They're not really in a position to do so. I mean, things are economically dire in Iran. They've also got their own leadership problems. A lot of their leadership died off during COVID, and they're still struggling to re-regulate after that. In terms of what that would look like, The reality is that would probably just be more missiles at this point. Iran does have ground troops in Syria across Israel's other border, but any sort of full-scale invasion would turn into an international war because America would be unable to not respond to anything like Tehran trying to send ground troops into Israel. So even if they were to get a bit more involved, it would be unlikely to be anything more than more missiles at this point.
Yeah. Leila, let's look at Gaza now, because Al Jazeera footage shows unarmed Palestinian men, one repeatedly waving a piece of white cloth in a sign of surrender, being shot dead by Israeli forces and then buried by a bulldozer near Gaza City. Do we know if this footage is verified, and are there any further details?
So there are actually multiple videos, sadly, of events like this happening recently. The one that you're referring to is actually in Khan Yunis, which is in southern Gaza. It came out a few days ago. Al Jazeera got hold of this footage. Now, Khan Yunis is the biggest city in southern Gaza. It's an active conflict zone at the moment. Israeli forces are occupying it. And Al Jazeera journalists got this footage from a drone that was shot down, an Israeli drone that was shot down. And it's horrifying to watch. We see four men walking along, and a missile hits them. Two of them are immediately killed. One man just to run ahead. He's then hit by another missile. And the last man is stumbling along, evidently injured. And he's then also hit by a missile. Now, these men appear to have been looking through the ruins of their homes, which many people have been doing because they have nowhere to stay. They're constantly trying to figure out where to go. They're trying to get hold of belongings and food because they have nothing. One of these men, as you say, is evidently waving a white flag. And the Israelis at the moment, they say that they are looking into this. But this consistent claim from the Israeli army that they are the most moral army in the world, that they're doing everything they can to avoid civilian casualties. There are now multiple videos that have come out of these conflict zones of things like this. Other people waving white flags, groups of people with women in being shot as they try to escape from conflict areas. And pressure is mounting against the Israeli authorities to answer to this kind of footage. At the moment, they say they're in the middle of a war. These are conflict zones. They'll look into it and they'll issue their own reports.
So a couple of US-based think tanks have said that at least six armed Palestinian groups are battling Israeli forces around Al-Shifa Hospital. We're hearing all these accounts of these horrific deaths and so on. But how strong do you believe Hamas fighters remain within Gaza?
So how strong they remain is incredibly difficult to assess because, of course, they have a complex of underground tunnels, we know, which has turned out to be nowhere near as extensive as Israel claimed it was. The issue with Al-Shifa, which was once, you know, Gaza's sort of greatest hospital complex, was that the Israeli authorities said that they knew there was a control and command bunker underneath the hospital. Now, the reason they knew that was because the Israelis built it themselves in the 80s when they were in control of the Gaza Strip. But they said that it had been massively overdeveloped and was where it was kind of the nerve center of Hamas. Once they took over Al-Shifa Hospital a few months ago, it became clear that wasn't the case. Now, the vast majority of people around Gaza City, where Al-Shifa is, have been evacuated, well, have evacuated themselves to the south around Rafah. 1.7 million out of Gaza's 2.4 million population have gone to the south. But there are still around 300,000 people living in the north, because there's really not anywhere else to go. And so much of Gaza's housing stock, more than 60% now, has been destroyed. Now, within the hospital, it does seem that there are fighters who, from what we can see from satellite footage, from images we've managed to get out of these hospitals, because, of course, international press is not allowed to freely report in Gaza, and especially not in this part of Gaza. It's so dangerous to move around, and Israel is not creating the capacity for them to report. But we can see that it does look like there are fighters inside. Israel says they have killed at least 170, detained another 500. But there are many families living around the area who have been reporting horrific missile strikes on family homes, dozens of women and children dying. And the other issue is there are still patients and doctors inside Al-Shifa. One doctor was reported as being killed a few days ago in this siege on Al-Shifa Hospital because he refused to leave his patients and he was then executed. So there are a lot of questions over who actually these people inside are. And the other question, of course, is whether fighters are taking over the hospital and there are civilians inside as well, or whether it's just being used as a fighting base. It does seem clear from everything we've seen, there are a lot of these people are actually civilians. And of course, Israel has now taken the stance that if you are a man of fighting age and you refuse to leave this area, you are a fighter. They've decided that, whether or not actually you're associated with any fighting group.
Leila, just finally, it's been reported that Israel has asked to reschedule a meeting with US officials to discuss its military plans for a ground invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. Now, this comes just days after Netanyahu abruptly scrapped the talks. Do we think this is moving in the right direction?
So we've been going back and forth on these talks now for months. Of course, we had before Christmas, we had a brief ceasefire in which about half the hostages were released back to Israel. Now, those were women, they were elderly women. The men are much more of an issue, of course, because and also, indeed, there are some female Israeli soldiers as well who are considered by Hamas to be combatants rather than civilians who were kidnapped. Now, Israel reckons that at least 30 of the remaining around 130 hostages are already dead. So that's part of the negotiation, as they want their bodies back. But these are soldiers and Hamas doesn't want to release them easily. Now, the sticking point here is Hamas has repeatedly come back to the table and said, we will only have a ceasefire this time. That is a permanent ceasefire. Israel says that's not going to happen. Netanyahu says Hamas are fantasists for thinking this could happen. But the reality is we've got around 1.7 million civilians in the Rafah area who, if there is a campaign, they have nowhere else to go. Thousands more people will die. 32,000 people are dead already. And the US is starting to get very frustrated and publicly frustrated now with Israel. For instance, Israel is saying they think they've killed around 13,000 Hamas fighters. Now, that number is only even remotely possible if you consider that every man over the age of about 13 who's died was a Hamas fighter. So the numbers that are coming out are just not realistic. And America's getting very frustrated with Israel's inability to engage with the level of civilian horror that is emerging, that it has been for months out of this war. Now, this UN resolution that finally passed a few days ago, it only called for a ceasefire until the end of Ramadan, which is now in 10 days. So we're unlikely to actually see this happen. But Israel reacted furiously to the fact that the US, for the first time, rather than vetoing it, abstained, and they cancelled the delegation they had going to the US, which was supposed to discuss this potential ground invasion in Rafah, which the US is trying to stop. So things aren't looking great at the moment on either side in terms of the negotiations.
Leila, thank you very much indeed. That's Leila Malala Allen, and this is The Globalist. It's 8:14 in Warsaw, 7:14 here in London. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, tariffs on Ukrainian food imports to the EU were dropped in an attempt to help keep the Ukrainian economy afloat after the Kremlin's invasion crippled its agricultural sector. Many of Ukraine's previous export routes, including through the Black Sea, have been blocked by war. But Ukraine's EU neighbours say the imports have upset their markets, leading to protests by farmers and truckers. workers. And across Europe, there have been waves of protests by food producers. Warsaw and Paris are now leading efforts to harden a provisional deal struck last week that would put caps on many Ukrainian imports in return for extending the tariff-free regime. Well, I'm joined now by Alice Hancock, EU correspondent for the Financial Times. Good morning to you, Alice. Thanks for joining us. What are the details of this provisional deal?
So the provisional deal involves caps on a series of products, as you mentioned, so oats, eggs, sugar, maize. And it was struck last week, but there was immediately a sort of backlash from certain member states, France and Poland among them. And indeed, yesterday evening, ambassadors met again and they've revised it to, as you say, keep allowing Ukrainian agricultural products to be imported, but to have an upper limit on those, which would equal the average amount imported between July 2021 and December 2023.
And how's Ukraine reacting to the proposed new terms?
Well, interestingly, we interviewed the Ukrainian agricultural minister on Monday, and he said that, you know, revenues that don't come to the Ukraine now are revenues that can't go towards its war effort. So in effect, you know, hitting the Ukraine will potentially prolong the war. I think the estimates at the moment mean that the limits that have been put in place will cost the Ukraine $330 million in lost revenues. But of course, there are other routes opening up, and the Black Sea is, you know, the situation there is beginning to ease. So there's a possibility that it could recover in other areas, but it's still a very serious situation.
And I mean, are some of these problems due, as Ukraine seems to imply, to bumper harvests in the US and Latin America? It's not all about Ukraine.
There's a whole raft of issues prompting the farmers' protests. I think there's been building issues over many, many years. Europe is a continent of small farmers. They are very hit by the increasing industrialization and growth of many of the, you know, these huge farms in the US and Latin America, as you say. They've been hit by environmental bureaucracy, the volatility of prices due to the war. And this is sort of, it's almost a symbolic issue now. You know, it's a kind of an easy target for them. And I was down at protests indeed on Tuesday, narrowly avoiding getting egged. But some of the things that the Brussels are trying to do, indeed, which involve loosening environmental standards. It's a very hard message to tell farmers all these sort of technocratic changes. What they want is a fair price for their products and you know, less red tape. And cutting imports to Ukraine is a really obvious and kind of top-level way to help them.
And I wonder how a deal like that will be agreed. I mean, does one country have more power than any other?
Well, no. I mean, in theory, the EU treaty and the single market is that all countries should act together. And when originally the EU did put in some trade restrictions on Ukrainian imports into the five bordering countries because of these market distortions. But in September, it decided to lift that ban and then put in this trade regime that you mentioned. But at that time, Hungary, Slovakia and Poland did introduce their own unilateral measures, which is why the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk and the Ukrainian Premier Denis Shmyhal are meeting today again, the latest in a series of talks, to see if they can find some agreement. Because in fact, Poland is one of Ukraine's good allies in this. It has been a staunch supporter of Ukraine since the beginning of the war in terms of military supplies and so forth and refugees. So it's really important that Europe shows unity on this, especially at this moment, which is so crux for Ukraine, with Russia showing sort of the advantage, potentially issues with aid for Ukraine held up in the US Congress and so forth.
And of course, the other big thing is the European parliamentary elections. They're coming up in June, and it's expected that there will be a surge of support for far-right parties across the bloc. And I wonder how this plays into anti-Ukrainian sentiment amongst farmers.
Well, it's really interesting to see how the different parliamentary groups are trying to show that they are the party of the farmers, show that they are representing farmers' interests. But I think many of the farmers, and some of the farmers do indeed identify with some of the more far-right policies, especially when it comes to migration, you know, being undercut by cheap labour, trade agreements, which they feel are unfavourable. But in the end, I think I don't know how much the Ukraine, because many of the right-wing groups are also saying, you know, they stand, the centre-right groups say they stand solid with Ukraine. It will be interesting to see how this fractures and how the ballot plays out.
Mm. And in terms of any agreement coming up, what does Ukraine say the solution should be?
Well, Ukraine believes that the what so-called autonomous trade measures, which allows grain and other agricultural products into the bloc, should continue. They do understand there are market distortions, but they see also that Russian agricultural products, which have not been sanctioned at all, even, you know, we're 13 sanctions packages down in the EU, that hasn't, agricultural products have not been touched because of concerns that Putin will say that the EU is jeopardizing global food security. So, you know, Ukraine sort of says, well, actually, you know, why are you not putting tariffs on things like Russian wheat, which are being sold at very low prices and undercutting the market as well?
Mm. And so if there is a Poland or a Ukrainian deal, do you think that's enough to stop the wave of farmer protests across Europe? As you say, there are so many other factors pulling into this.
And frankly, no. I mean, I was speaking to Belgian farmers, French farmers, they're protesting and they're not on the border of Ukraine. Mm. Yes, there's market volatility issues, but there's so many more things in this. I mean, I speak to guys who have one farmer who is a sixth generation farmer, and his father had told him to go and get another job because he doesn't believe it's worth him taking on the farm. But he does his other job and he does the farm in the evening, and he pays 400 euros a month to keep the farm afloat because it's so difficult to get prices for his cattle at the moment. But farmers do it because they love it. I think it's we have to get into the mindset of the farmer who's done this for many years, and it's their livelihood. And I think politicians have got to work really hard to reconcile that with ambitious climate agenda, market volatility, and the need for Europe to sort of stay competitive on global markets.
Absolutely. Alice, thank you very much indeed. That's Alice Hancock there. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll head to Hungary, where thousands have rallied against Prime Minister Orbán. We'll find out why the Slovakian public broadcaster is under threat and ask, do Italians really use their hands more when they speak? Stay tuned. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. It's 7.22 here in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me down the line is Navina Couture, who is Monocle's Nairobi correspondent. Good morning to you, Navina.
Good morning to you in London.
Let's have a look at a good news story from Africa. This is, of course, Senegal and the election results there. We are now some way away from that, beginning to get some perspective on this new government. Tell me what this means for the country.
I think everyone is still trying to process what it actually means. He is bound to be the youngest president on the African continent. That has garnered a lot of interest, not just in the region, in Senegal or in West Africa, but on the entire continent. The Kenyan papers have been covering it heavily, especially because we don't know that much about him. He, Mr. Faye, he basically published his wealth declaration yesterday. I think it's a very strategic move to answer some of these demands that the public have been making for more transparency by the government. He published how much land he owns, how much property he owns, what his assets are, his loans he has taken out. So I think he started on a very kind of transparent mode. And I think we'll have to see. He has promised, or he has said he's considering introducing a new currency in Senegal, reducing the dependency on France. He also said he's considering renegotiating some of the contracts. But I think we have to see how he maneuvers the next couple of months and year, really.
Yeah. As you say, he's the youngest leader in Africa. What does this mean for the youth in Senegal?
I think what the youth really want, and we've been seeing this since there were protests in 2021, so 3 years ago, younger people in Senegal really want job creation. They want an improvement to the quality of public education, and they're really looking for an improvement of the quality of life from the government. And I think that's where the government has, or actually they perceive the government to have failed, that even though Senegal has enjoyed 5%, 5% growth in the last couple of years. There has been a lot of spending on roads, railways and ports. This hasn't really translated into an improvement of the economic reality of many people who live there. And the majority of people who live there, as well as on the rest of the continent, are very young.
Let's go now to another country that was hailed as one of Africa's success stories. Sadly, looking no longer quite so shiny, and that's South Africa. Just 2 months to go to the elections and all sorts of squabbling. The ANC was taking legal action against the former president, Jacob Zuma. They appear to have lost that. Will you unpick that story for us?
Yes, exactly. The former president, Jacob Zuma, who was forced out of office over corruption allegations, announced that he was going to set up his own party, leave the ANC. And the ANC tried to stop this by claiming that the new party did not meet official registration criteria. That means this party called MK Party will be able to run in exactly 2 months from now. And this is certainly the biggest election on the continent. It's the biggest economy on the continent. And we see a lot of concern, but also hope that it will come with some stability. We're expecting the ANC to lose its majority, and the DA party that has been in opposition for the last couple of years is offering itself as a coalition partner. And I think the next 2 months will show sort of how the election campaign develops and what this could mean in the coming years.
Yep. Let's move to Sudan now, where there are hopes for peace talks in April.
Yes, I think there's a sense that the conflict in Sudan that has, I think we're approaching the 1 year anniversary in mid-April, has really suffered. Or there has been very little attention on Sudan because of the conflict in Gaza. The new U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, has announced that he's hoping for a resumption of peace talks in Sudan by April 18th. That would be after Ramadan. I think he's also hoping for this to happen again in Saudi Arabia with the participation of regional players like Egypt, the United Arab Emirates. So I think we have to wait and see how this pans out, but there seems to be a sort of renewed diplomatic effort to bring the warring factions to the negotiating table.
Now, we know that there are many warring factions there, and in fact, they're helped by outsiders. There are reports that both Ukrainian special forces and Wagner mercenaries are fighting in Sudan after backing rival sides in the country's civil war. And that brings us to our next story, which is Ukraine looking to increase influence in Africa. How is that manifesting?
Yes, this is based on a report by Semaphore Africa. Zelensky is apparently planning to visit South Africa in the coming months. He's also doubling the number of embassies and has expanded grain shipments to the continent. I think it's always kind of important to recall how much the continent has suffered from these grain shipments being stopped, both from Russia as well as from Ukraine. It has really led to an increase in inflation. And this is at the same time as Russia and other countries are trying to kind of increase their diplomatic efforts here. Russia has very close ties to West African countries that are led by military regimes, the Central African Republic, Mali, Burkina Faso. And I think Ukraine is trying to counter that. Also, in order to increase influence, it is looking to Ghana in the Security Council.
But I mean, it seems unlikely that Ukraine can ever match Russia, which has been entrenched in many parts of Africa for decades.
Exactly. I think it's Russia has been, as you say, entrenched on the continent for a very long time. It has basically fostered these relations. That's what we're hearing from African diplomats over and over again, fostered relations in places like Mali over decades, where diplomats were based for a very long time, had very good networks. So I think it is a tall order, but there are obviously countries that are sympathetic to the Ukrainian cause. And I think the embassies will pop up in countries where Zelensky thinks there is a bit of leeway to negotiate and maybe increase their influence or support for Ukraine.
Finally, let's go to Uganda, where civil servants are being encouraged to, get off their fat asses.
Yes, I have to say I was quite surprised to read that, because when I was in Uganda, I found the diet quite healthy. Lots of vegetables, lots of grains, very plant-based. So you would think that's a good start. But the Ugandan government has instructed all civil servants to exercise for 2 hours every week to keep fit and healthy. I guess as everywhere around the world, people are spending more time behind their desks, especially civil servants are quite renowned to do so. So there is a directive going around from the head of public service, who said that these exercise sessions would help save the lives of staff and reduce disease burden. I was quite amused to see that this was even picked up as far as Ghana. So it's obviously something that is resounding around the continent.
Mm. Well, and as you say, very topical. Everybody is doing this at the moment. I have to say, the picture illustrating this of civil servants doing exercise, none of them look unhealthy at all. They look fabulous. So I'm not quite sure what they're on about. Naveena, thank you very much indeed. That's Naveena Couture there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The pilot of the cargo freighter that knocked down a highway bridge into Baltimore Harbor in the early hours of Tuesday morning had radioed for tugboat help and reported a power loss minutes earlier, federal safety officials said, citing audio from the ship's black box data recorder. The economic fallout of the bridge collapse could be staggering. The port handles more automobile and farm equipment freight than any other in the country, as well as container freight and bulk goods ranging from sugar to coal. As many as 95 people are still missing after last week's attack near Moscow, when gunmen sprayed concertgoers with automatic weapons and set the venue on fire, according to a Russian news outlet. The official toll from the attack on Crocus City Hall stands at 140 dead and 182 wounded. Russian investigators said the attack was carried out by four shooters using Kalashnikov automatic weapons. And bus drivers in the South Korean capital of Seoul went on strike today after last-ditch efforts at negotiating a wage hike broke down, snarling the commute for the city of more than 9 million people and another million from the outskirts. South Korea also has an ongoing doctor's strike as thousands of trainee doctors have walked off their jobs in protest against the government's plans to increase medical school admissions. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. In Budapest, thousands of people protested near Parliament on Tuesday, demanding the resignation of the chief prosecutor and the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. This comes after a former government insider accused a senior aide to Orban of trying to interfere in a graft case and follows a sex abuse scandal that brought down two of Orban's political allies. Well, I'm joined now from Budapest by Justin Spike, who is AP's Hungary correspondent. Justin, many thanks for coming on the show once again. Can you remind us of the facts of this corruption case?
Good morning. Thanks for having me again. So it's a bit of a convoluted case, but I'll try to keep it simple for the benefit of your listeners. There was a corruption case which kind of went up to some of the higher levels of government. This was revealed a couple of years ago, but has mostly played out in Hungarian media. And essentially what happened is that there was a state secretary who was receiving bribery payments from someone who was working on the board of bailiffs. And this was revealed, and it was thought that it could the payoffs and the corruption could reach up to higher levels in government. And then what ended up happening is this former government insider, Peter Magyar, he came out and said that he has proof that in fact the corruption went even higher and that high-level government officials were trying to cover it up.
And so this is the reason why it's all blown up again now.
Yes, that's correct. It's kind of come back into the news headlines. And indeed, a couple of days ago, this Peter Magyar, who is the ex-husband of the former Minister of Justice, he produced an audio recording of a conversation he had with his former wife, in which she seemed to intimate that indeed one of Prime Minister Orban's right-hand men caused certain evidence to be removed from the court documents in this corruption case. So that suggests, you know, direct interference from the highest levels of government.
But it gets even more convoluted because his ex-wife had to resign over a sex scandal abuse.
Right. This is what really started all of this off. Back in early February, it was revealed that that the president issued a pardon to a man who had been convicted and was serving prison time for helping cover up child sexual abuse in a state-run orphanage. So once this was revealed that she had issued this pardon, it caused massive outrage across the country, and she was ultimately forced to resign. And so too was the justice minister, Judith Varga, because her signature was needed to countersign that pardon. So from this initial scandal sort of blew up this secondary scandal, because that's when Peter Magyar comes onto the scene and starts saying, hey, you know, I was an insider for years. I was married to the justice minister. I know where the skeletons are hiding in the closet.
But now the justice minister is releasing her own video accusing him of spousal abuse.
Yes, it gets rather soap opera-y in the past few days. And last night, in fact, she released a 2-hour-long interview on YouTube after spending several days making Facebook posts intimating that she had been abused by Peter Magyar while they were still married, and that people shouldn't take him seriously. He's a narcissist. He's an opportunist looking for his own political career. Now, indeed, Peter Magyar, he has announced that he's starting a new political party. He's trying to, you know, sort of corner the political market from the center right, people who are disaffected with Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party. So he does have political ambitions. But then a lot of his supporters are of the belief that that what the former justice minister is doing is just smearing him and using tactics which they think are familiar, you know, have the familiar signs of a government launched smear campaign to discredit him and preserve their power.
Yeah, and just quickly before we go, we know that in June there'll be European parliamentary elections. In light of that, how serious a blow is this to Orban?
I think that none of it really looks good. I don't think it's welcome. Any of these scandals are welcome for Orban and his party, and especially, you know, the presidential pardon case to a man convicted in a child sexual abuse case. That's just that goes at the heart of Orban's image as a right wing Christian, as a supporter of family values and traditional values. So I think that it could whittle away at some of their support in elections this summer. That said, I think it's going to be tough for Peter Magyar in such a short time. You know, we've got less than 3 months until the elections, in such a short time to put together a really consolidated political force that could threaten Orban and his party's performance in the elections.
Justin, thank you very much indeed. That's Justin Spike in Budapest there. This is Monocle Radio. RTVS is the Slovak state-funded broadcaster, which, according to the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, enjoys a high level of public trust. And yet, the government of Slovakia, which joined the European Union in 2004, wants to rename the public service broadcaster STAR, short for Slovak Television and Radio, fire the director, and take full editorial control. Unsurprisingly, this has met with much resistance from journalists, human rights bodies and the opposition. Well, I'm joined now for more on this story by the journalist Rob Cameron. Rob, many thanks for coming on the show. I wondered if you could start by telling us about the current media landscape in Slovakia.
Well, Slovakia's media landscape is very diverse. It's obviously quite young, Slovakia being a young country, and it ranges hugely from a number of very well-respected private media, private publications such as Denik N or SME or Aktuality SK, which are very well-regarded leading liberal dailies and online news servers, Markiza Television, a very popular commercial TV station, and then the public television and radio server broadcaster, RTVS, which is seen as perhaps a slightly staid but very respectable and respected public broadcaster that a lot of Slovaks turn to for news. But apart from that, there is obviously a panoply of smaller online news stations and TV channels, many of which, of course, spew out disinformation, whether it's about COVID or the war in Ukraine. And many of them maintain this pro-Moscow narrative. And worryingly, the culture minister of Slovakia, the person who is spearheading this initiative to bring the public broadcaster to heel and make it fully under control of the Slovak government, a populist nationalist government, is herself a leading figure on one of these online disinformation channels. So that's the situation in Slovakia at the moment. And you can see why so many people are so angry about it.
So what exactly is it that the government is seeking to change?
Well, everything, basically. The government bill, which was submitted to Parliament, envisages the current public broadcaster simply ceasing to exist in a matter of weeks, essentially. The director, who was only appointed last year, would lose his job immediately, and it would be replaced, as you said in your introduction, by a new broadcaster called Star, Slovak Television and Radio. It wouldn't be a wholly state broadcaster, but it would have all the trappings of one. It would be almost fully under the government's control. The way that the station is run and managed would be no longer under mostly the control of an independent board and parliament, but directly under the government's control. And there would be this editorial board elected by parliament, where Mr. Fico, the prime minister, has a majority, which would control the output of the station. All of this, of course, goes against the accepted guidelines of public broadcasting in Europe. So that's why organizations such as the EBU and Reporters Without Borders and the European Union itself has said that, no, this is simply unacceptable.
Because, I mean, it is completely against EU legislation. I mean, what could the ramifications then be from the European Union?
That's yet to be determined, because it should be said, it should be stressed, that the government does appear to be slightly spooked by the reaction, and also, I think, has taken a step back away from pushing this measure through because of the presidential elections in Slovakia that take place in a week's time. The government's preferred candidate, Peter Pellegrini, he came second, quite far behind the person who emerged in first place, a Liberal candidate. And I think the cabinet of Robert Fico and his coalition allies were a bit spooked by that. And so they don't want to go ahead with this right now, because that will give the opposition more ammunition. There are people already demonstrating in the streets about the fate of Slovak radio and television. So they don't want to give them more opportunity to do so. So it seems that observers believe that the government is going to take a step back, put the legislation on ice for a few weeks, maybe a month or two, and then return to it when they feel more confident about getting it through. And that, of course, will partly depend on how well the government's candidate does in the presidential election.
Of course, this is not the first time they've tried this.
Absolutely not. I mean, it did happen in Slovakia many years ago under Vladimir Mečiar, the authoritarian leader of Slovakia, many years ago now. And he, of course, his measures, including taking direct control of the public broadcaster, ended up Slovakia seeing itself being derailed on the way to joining the EU and NATO. And in fact, NATO, it took much longer to join. So obviously there are serious ramifications. And I think partly because of that, in fact, the government has already said that, no, this part, one part of the bill that would allow the director to be sacked pretty much without any reason, they've taken that out, because that does directly go against the mainstream in terms of European broadcasting. But the other measures, recreating this public broadcaster and renaming it and changing the way it's run, I think they will try and ram that through, yes.
Was there a particular incident which prompted this latest clampdown?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a result of the slow, steady turn away from Western liberal democracy that the parties that make up the current coalition government, headed by Robert Fico, has taken in the past few years. Robert Fico used to be a fairly acceptable, if that's the right word, so a fairly hardline but social democrat politician. And the COVID pandemic really turned him into a rabble-rousing populist. And ever since then, We've seen a much harsher version of Robert Fico. And now, of course, he's back in power. And he feels, at least, that he's able to remodel Slovakia to his liking, perhaps along the lines of an illiberal democracy like the Hungary of Viktor Orban.
And how much public support does he have?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? He won the election, and that was perhaps partly due just to the fragmented nature of Slovak politics and the fact that standing against him, railed against him, are so many different smaller conservative and Christian Democrat and centre-right and Hungarian parties, and they just could not get together to form another majority to defeat him. So because the voter base is so fragmented, the electorate is so fragmented in Slovakia, it's difficult to say which half, because Slovakia is becoming very divided, has a majority in society at any one time. For now, it's narrowly Fico, but we'll see what happens now in the presidential election and see if that majority, that coalition of pro-Fico forces still has the upper hand in Slovakia. And for many Slovaks, taking over the public broadcaster, which it does enjoy a place, you know, in their hearts, may be going too far. And some even believe that Mr. Fico may drop the whole idea altogether and concentrate on boosting those online disinformation channels or private commercial media that is favorable and not hostile, as he says, to him, and trying to freeze out the liberal pro-Western media that he says has it in for his government.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. That was Rob Cameron, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, it's time now for a roundup of architecture and design news with Tim Abrams, who's contributing editor at Architectural Record. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning to you, Tim.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Did you love Succession?
I loved Succession. It's probably my favourite of the box sets that have yet to grace our airwaves. A programme which had intrigue and everything. Shakespearean almost, some
absolutely.
Would say.
But there is a kind of real-life version if you look closely enough at LVMH and the Arnault family.
Indeed. The recent moves at the LVMH, which is by far and away Europe's largest company in terms of market capitalisation. And what we have is Bernard Arnault announced, the leader of the company, CEO, announced that his long-standing deputy, Antonio Belloni, was stepping down. And in the background, not just one, not just two, not just three, not just four, as we have in Succession, but five of his children are in the wings, looking forward to the succession, shall we say, in the future of the company. There is now four of his children on the board of LVMH. And the implications are intriguing for the future of Europe's largest company.
Mm. Now, of course, we don't know whether they have the amount of animosity between them that the Roy family did. But putting your family in key positions, is this any way to effectively run a company? It's not a minor fashion house, after all.
It is not a minor fashion house. One of the interesting aspects of LVMH, though, is that each individual brand and companies like Louis Vuitton, Dior, Tiffany, it's watch brands, operate quite independently. They have their own sense of identity and they have their own market. It's a very successful agglomeration of different strong brands. And the children have been set their own agendas and given different parts of it. One of the sons looks after the communications, another looks after Louis Vuitton, Jean's looking after the watches. It's still many fiefdoms, but it looks like it's all coming together for a very interesting mix in the years to come.
But this article in The Telegraph does warn that if he gets it wrong, it's not just this that comes crashing down. It affects the luxury goods business and, in fact, many family fortunes come crashing down all over Europe. Let's move on to Barcelona. And, of course, everybody who's been there knows the Sagrada Familia. It is not complete, but might be in 2026.
Incredibly, given the fact that the construction began in 1882, it looks like the Sagrada Familia, at least in its kind of complete envelope, it's nearing completion. The company reports announced that 2026 will be the completion date for the body of the building. There are other elements, other components, which will be added to later. But as a complete building, yeah, it looks like it's going to actually finish.
But there's quite a lot of controversy around it because there's a stairway which would extend across two city blocks that would dislodge about 1,000 families and businesses. And there's some argument about whether that stairway was actually part of Gaudi's initial plan.
The problem is that a bunch of anarchists burnt larger numbers of the plans for the Sagrada Familia during the Civil War period. So we're not entirely sure. There is a constant debate between proponents of the cathedral and critics in the city who say, what is Gaudi's building and what isn't Gaudi? And this controversial staircase, imagine having to displace 1,000 people to build a staircase. That component is still up for debate. I think what's going to happen is that the city is pushing and the Sagrada Familia organization is putting to complete the building and then let this one ride out in the background.
Now to Bruges.
Yes, to Bruges. I think everyone should go to Bruges, actually. In Bruges, the film doesn't give the place a very fair representation. It's a wonderful place, and the architecture triennial that we're approaching is, I would say, one of the most eagerly looked forward to architectural events outside the Venice Biennale in the calendar, and it's just coming up, and I say get there.
And what's the theme?
The theme... These things always have it. It's called, I can't even remember.
Spaces of possibility.
You know, they always have to have a theme. But it's just the interesting thing about Bruges is they just build stuff. There's no kind of, we often in architecture at the moment, there's a great deal of concern about the environmental impact of it. One of the nice things about Bruges is that we remember that it's actually an art form and we see young, interesting architects exploring the idea of beautiful forms and sculpture.
And, of course, Bruges itself is a UNESCO-protected historic city. Non-building, therefore, has got to be the central call.
Well, one of the interesting things about Bruges is that I remember going to see a new building within the site of this UNESCO heritage site, a modern building, and I said, well, what's the implication here? And they said, well, we're in Belgium. We have the right to build new things. There's a very interesting and exciting relationship between the new and the old in Bruges and in the wider Flanders region, which I find really, really interesting. And it's bringing people from all around the world to interesting architects there to do interesting things.
And what's the best way then to immerse yourself in an architectural spectacle like this?
The best way to do it is get on the Eurostar and roll through the Flemish countryside and see the amazing way that the unique architecture of the history of Flanders, its brick buildings, and then just roll into Bruges and then suddenly find yourself in this canal scattered city, beautiful and ancient, and then suddenly see these surprising, interesting interventions which push forward the idea of architecture and the idea of modern architecture being a friend of traditional architecture.
Tim, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That's Tim Abrams there, and you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Everyone gestures when they speak. It's something that happens across cultures and languages. But now, a new report shows that the amount we may be influenced by our ethnicity. Well, let's cross now to Sweden, where I'm joined by Dr. Maria Graziano, who's Associate Professor at Lund University's Humanities Lab and co-author of The Frontiers in Communication, written with Professor Marianne Gullberg. Good morning to you, Maria.
Good morning. Hi. Good morning.
Now, tell us, what were the findings of your study, Frontiers in Communication?
Yes, well, in this study, my colleague Marianne Gullberg and I compare gestures that are produced by Italian and Swedish speakers while they tell a story to a friend. And so both groups, I want to say, gesture quite a lot. But what we find particularly interesting in the results is that they gesture differently in terms of function. They use the gestures. So this means that Swedes tend to use a gesture to represent events and actions that have happened in the story or characteristics of the characters they are talking about. And Italians instead tend to use the pragmatic gestures, which mainly are used to comment on the story and to present new parts of the story to the listener.
So, I mean, how does this change based on nationality? What is the key difference that makes these gesturing behaviours different?
Well, I mean, what we think is not really a matter, of the nationality. It's really about the way in which we are interpreting these results is that the speakers of the two languages use different rhetorical styles when they talk about the story. And this is, they have a different way to conceptualize the story, which is, if you want, a little bit more concrete in the Swedish production and a little bit more abstract or more careful about the presentation of the parts of the story that are interesting in Italian. So that's the main difference that we see here. And this difference is seen only if we consider gestures, because the structural organization of the story in terms of speech is very similar in the two languages. So it is really the gesture that gives this information about how the speakers of these two languages organize the story.
And what do we know about the gestures themselves? Do they change based on the tone of the conversation or the theme or indeed the cultural context?
Well, that is something that we don't really know, at this point, not empirically. Of course, there are stereotypical ideas about this. I mean, we know, for example, that there is a set of gestures that are called conventional or emblems that are specific to different cultures. So this means that their meaning is codified and you can't really understand it outside another culture. But how these change, the production of gestures change in respect, for example, to the psychological traits of every individual, this we don't really know. Again, there are stereotypical ideas about that, but they're not based on empirical data. So the answer is we don't really know for sure. We need more data to answer to this question, actually.
So storytelling has obviously been part of humanity since the beginning of time. How crucial is gesturing to that?
Yeah, I think it's very much so. And the gesture is a salient part of every type of discourse we produce in all the languages. I would say that the moment you speak, you also gesture at a certain point of your discourse. And something that this study shows is that in storytelling, there is a different way of conceptualizing the story, a different way in which you construct the story, a different way in which you think what is important to deliver in the story. And this is shown, as we see here, at least in the comparison between Italian and Swedish speakers, this is shown in gesture.
And what should we pay more attention to, the gesture or the speech?
Well, there is no way we can separate the two. When we process information that we receive from a speaker, we take into consideration both speech and gesture together at the same time. And there are many studies out there that clearly show this. Listeners do pay attention to the gestures as much as they pay attention to the speech. So because speech and gesture are tightly integrated in the moment in which we conceive an idea, a concept we want to talk about, then we produce a speech and gesture together, and the listener will consider speech and gesture together.
Excellent. Dr. Maria Graziano, I am waving now at you, if only you could see me. Thanks very much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Laura Kramer, Carlotta Ribello and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Tamsin Howard. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. And I'll be back on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.